This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2011 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library and Flinders University Library.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'd like to welcome you to this session. Welcome to the Adelaide Festival of Ideas. And today's session is, how will climate change affect your food? I had a voice a minute ago. My name is Bob Gibson. I head up a group called Food Plus Research Centre based out at the Waite campus of Adelaide University. And I have a passionate interest in this area since I think one of the major determinants of food production is going to be trying to second guess climate change. I want to let you all know that this session is being recorded today. So I'm going to ask you all if you will do two things. First of all, if you want to ask a question, there'll be 15 minutes at the end of this session for questions from the floor and general discussion, but please do so into the microphone at the end. The other thing to help things along, if you will please turn your gadgets to silent, please, because that will disturb people. You're, of course, most welcome to tweet. At Ideas Adelaide, and the hashtag is #AFOI. And I would like to say to also welcome you to country. I acknowledge today that we are gathered on the traditional country of the Kaurna people of the Adelaide Plains. We recognise and respect their cultural heritage, beliefs and relationship to the land. We acknowledge that they are of continuing importance to the Kaurna people living today, and we respect their elders past and present. There are two speakers today, and we're incredibly lucky to get them. Both are experts and incredibly interesting people. Mark Howden is Chief Research Scientist with CSIRO Ecosystems Sciences in Canberra, and is leader of Adaptive Primary Industries, Enterprises and Communities theme in the CSIRO Climate Adaptation Flagship and Honorary Professor at Melbourne University. I think one of the things that Mark's greatest claim to fame is the fact that he was a contributor to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and he shares the 2007 Nobel Prize, Peace Prize with Al Gore, amongst others. So it's incredibly great honour for me to welcome Mark to the lectern. Mark.
Thanks for that introduction, Bob, and thanks to the organisers for this opportunity to talk to you, the good citizens of Adelaide. In my presentation today, which I have to go back one, what I'm doing here is actually talking about the climate change impacts on food or potential impacts on food and food systems. This is a little bit different from some of the other talks which have been given at the festival, which actually focus particularly on how the greenhouse gas emissions embodied in food and water may impact on global change itself. So in this talk, I'm actually going to particularly focus on these things up at the top here, which is opportunity, risk and success. I'll be looking across different aspects of the food chain, but pretty briefly. This is a very quick skate over a very broad field. And I'd also like to acknowledge my co-authors, Udai Nijimolu and Peter Heyman, who are in the audience, as well as colleagues such as Brian Foster, who have been integral to the development of this area of work. I'd also like to acknowledge the traditional owners, the Kaurna people, because they themselves actually lived through several climate changes of quite significance. So just in the interests of actually overturning the theme of this festival, which is actually planning for uncertainty, I'm actually giving you planning for certainty here. So I'm actually going to tell you what I'm going to talk about in this presentation. Hi, Ian. And then those of you who have heard me can actually then leave without listening to the rest of it. But, of course, you want to stay for Amanda. The first thing I'm trying to do is actually start to reframe this question a little bit. At the moment, one of the core debates in this is actually trying to put climate science and the uncertainties associated with that at the core of the debate. And then you have things like greenhouse gas emission reduction policies and activities and adaptation activities and various other things sort of sitting on the outside of this big bubble in the middle. And I actually think that's a flawed perspective on this particular issue. I actually think we have to reframe this as something a little bit different, which I'll talk about. I'll actually just very briefly give a little bit of the evidence of the changes that are already happening in terms of our climate and the fact that they are very likely due to human activities. Also, a little bit of a taste of what might be coming down our way, down the tracks in terms of climate, because this change is increasingly likely to be inevitable as far as we can tell. Those changes that I'm going to talk about are very significant in terms of activities here in South Australia and elsewhere, and they will affect things that we value, including food systems and agriculture. So they're things that we need to be concerned about. There are many adaptations possible, which I'll talk a little bit about, that give people better alternatives. So that the key driver, in my view, for adaptation is not about top-down imposition, but it's actually about giving people better options that they can implement in their own lives. I don't think, however, that adaptation, an effective adaptation, is inevitable. I think we actually do have to do things to make this happen in a reasonable way across the broad sweep of society. And part of this is actually starting to make adaptation normal, not exceptional, but it's actually just an integral part of our day-to-day activities, our ideas and our ideals. And that should, in a sense, be the same for dealing with greenhouse gas mitigation. That's the emission reduction side of the things. However, even if we do adapt well, with the sort of changes that we might encounter, that will not be enough. So there's still a residual between perhaps where we might like to see our food production systems and our society and our natural resource management and what we may have to deal with. Now, in terms of reframing, as I just mentioned, one of the problems here is that the climate science has tended to dominate a lot of the funding activities and a lot of the discussion, and the uncertainties inherent in this actually give a leverage point for people who want to, for various reasons, dispute climate change, and some degree of disputation is quite legitimate. But, in fact, what we actually do in this process is we put that climate science at the core of the issue. And yet there is still significant uncertainty about that climate science, and there always will be uncertainty about that climate science. In the process of it, it tends to devalue those things which, in my view, are much more important. And those are the values and decisions that we as individuals, communities, society actually have. And we should start to reframe this, in my view, as putting those at the core of the issue, and then the climate is either an input into that or a consequence of that, in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. And if we actually start to do that, I think we can actually change the debate. We can change it from being something which is externally imposed on us to something which we can actually own and which we can change for ourselves. And I think that's a fundamentally important thing. And in doing this, my view is we actually start out pragmatically with those things that we can broadly agree on that are important to us. So we start at the bottom of our chain of important things, those things like clean and adequate food, water, shelter. And if we actually start to look at those things and focus on what we can do about them, so it's not just the fact that there's a problem, but it's also something that is matched with potential solutions, then we can actually start to build from the bottom up a set of changes in activities and behaviours which arguably, according to psychological theory, will eventually lead to changes in attitudes and values. So rather than a top-down process, which tends to have happened in the past, I actually think we should start looking at adaptation as an opportunity to build up a bottom-up consensus on climate change issues. Now, this is a really important graph in my view. What this does is it indicates greenhouse gas emissions, which are, in a sense, the core of the issue. They're a human activity. This is the human-centred view of life. And what this does is it shows these coloured lines out here are the scenarios for greenhouse gas emissions, which were produced about a decade ago. So there's some low-end scenarios, which are a low economic growth, sort of low population growth scenarios. And then there's some high-end scenarios called the fossil fuel intensive scenario, like that line there. And these dots here are actually what's happened over this period of time, so going back about 20 years. And in a sense, these things having been published about 10 years ago are not truly a prediction, but they are a spectrum of possibilities that the scientists and others who constructed these scenarios thought was feasible, internally consistent. And what we can actually see with these greenhouse gas emissions here and up here is that, with the exception of the global financial crisis, the actual emissions have exceeded the worst-case scenario thought possible as little as 10 years ago. And if we look at the other key indicators of climate change, that's carbon dioxide concentrations, global temperature change and sea level change, in all cases they are at or above the worst case scenario thought as little as 10 years ago. So this is actually a really significant situation where we're actually tracking worse than the worst case scenario, and that's the reality. This isn't a projection, this is the reality. And the important part of that too is those emissions have been going up something like 3% a year over this period. Obviously the bounce back from the global financial crisis is a fast one, but on average about 3% a year. And this is really important because, as this graph shows, is that we actually need to be decreasing emissions by about 2% a year to actually come in below a 2 degrees Celsius change target, if we think 2 degrees Celsius is the dangerous level of climate change. So that actually means the difference between plus 3 and minus 2 is 5%. So we actually have to turn around our economy to the tune of 1/20th of our emissions every year, year on year, out into the future. And I simply, at this stage, can't see that happening, unfortunately. The other interesting part of this graph is that if you go out to, say, if we start, what this says is that the earlier we start emission reductions, the less we have to do on a year-by-year basis. So if we wait to 2025 to start getting our act together on this, we have to reduce our emissions something like by 1/8 every year, until we get down to zero emissions, roughly in the mid-2040s. A huge task. I mean, if we think 5% a year is going to be a challenge, going down by 25% if you leave it to 2030 to start acting, or even 12% a year if we start acting a little bit earlier, is just going to be massive change. I don't think feasible within our systems. So essentially this says to me that we are committed one way or another, because of uncertainties and because of lags in our systems, in terms of our geopolitical systems, we are committed probably to at least 2 degrees change, possibly 4, possibly 6 or more. And that's the science debate at the moment, is not limiting our thinking to 2 degrees. Now, the basic theory of greenhouse gas emissions and climate change has been known since the 1800s. 1842 was the first observation of this. 1875, there was a measurement done of this. 1895, there was a paper produced on it by a Swedish chemist. And the basic story is, if we keep on putting out greenhouse gases, it's like putting blankets in our atmosphere, and it prevents energy which otherwise would go out of space. It keeps some of that next to the Earth. That's essentially the basis of the theory. And if the theory is right, then we've been producing lots of greenhouse gases, as I showed you just before, and we probably should have already started to see climate change. So if we actually look at what's going on our Earth and compare it with the projections of future change, what we find is extreme degrees of consistency between those two things. So, for example, we've got projections of increased temperatures, depending on the scenario, emission scenario, could be moderate to extreme. And what we actually find is that right across the globe, with a few tiny exceptions, those temperatures are going up. And if we look at South Australia, this is straight off the Bureau of Met website, we can actually see that there's been a sustained period of increase in temperatures. This is the black line, is the 10-year average, and that just keeps on going up and up and up. And there's no hint there of a reversal in this warming. Just like there's no hint there on the global average temperature increase of anything going backwards. You might hear media saying, oh, the Earth's cooling. That's simply not what's supported by the data. And interestingly, if you actually look at this average temperature which we're experiencing now, it's actually hotter than the hottest year ever experienced by my grandparents in those times. So we're already at the point where the average temperature is hotter than the hottest year experienced by those people. And very soon, we'll be at a situation where the coolest year we experience will be hotter than the hottest year ever experienced by our grandparents. A fundamental change in climate as we experience it. We've already seen increased temperature extremes, which are also anticipated to increase in the future. In Adelaide, March 2008, you had 15 days in a row which were greater than 35 degrees. I'm sure a lot of you remember that. The previous record, I think, was 8 or 7 or 8, and back in 1908, I think it might have been. And then 2009, we had another, it would have been another record set with 9 degrees in a row in February. So we're already seeing those extreme temperatures starting to ramp up, and they're happening in Adelaide and other places. We've seen reduced rainfall in southern Australia, the drought that we've conveniently forgotten because it rained last year, and we know something about the processes that are actually causing that drought. So what we've actually seen, so this is actually today's synoptic weather map from the Bureau of Met, and what we've actually seen is this big shift downwards in terms of our climate systems. So when I was a kid, and I used to look at these sort of things, typically at this time of year, in early to mid-spring, the high-pressure systems would be tracking over Alice Springs. All your cold fronts would be coming across here, dumping rainfall across the southern quarter of Australia, and everyone would be happy. Our rivers would be full, soil profiles would be full, crops would grow. The problem is now we're actually seeing these extraordinary changes in our systems, and they're really systematic changes. They're not just a blip. They're really, really strong signals. And what we're seeing is these high-pressure systems are starting to track much further south. I think my little thing's gone off the blink. So those high-pressure systems are actually starting to track at this time of year in Tasmanian latitudes, not Alice Springs-type latitudes, pushing those cold fronts down, pushing that rain down into the Southern Ocean. And we're getting these extraordinary incursions of tropical air coming in. So you can see those troughs coming in from the north, and so it's actually bringing in tropical air down into this part of the continent at this time of year. It's really extraordinary if you actually know anything about climatology. We've also seen increased rainfall in northern Australia, fostering suggestions to move our agriculture up there. We've seen increased rainfall intensity right across the board, again something that's consistent with our climate change projections. Reduced river flows, so we had record low flows in the Murray, and those flows are another key projection of climate change, minus 40% reductions at the extreme end by 2030 in the Murray River. And we've seen increased fire risk, so we don't have to remind anyone of fire risk in Australia, but it's really important to remind us about one of the key indicators of fire risk. So quite a while back, in response to that, we set up a fire danger index, which was rated from 0 to 100, 100 being the worst possible situation on record. In 2003, in Canberra, in my town, there was 113. Okay, maybe just chance that, you know, you get something that extreme. The 2009 fires in Victoria had a fire danger index of 180, 180. In spring of that year, you guys might have forgotten it, but there was actually an occurrence of a fire danger index of 215 in South Australia. So these are not marginal changes. These are absolutely serious, big changes, and we're seeing them already, and they are entirely consistent with our future expectations. So we got to the situation where people, and this is a quote from a farmer, he just says, you know, much of the rains come in summer storms, that's high-intensity events, and less in autumn, winter and spring. It's just like looking at the scientist scenarios coming, you know, true in front of our eyes. I thought a really telling quote where people are actually joining the dots between what they're seeing and what the scientists might be telling them might come. And as a result, we actually start to need to think about risk management in Australia's variable climate. So this is a classic quote, I reckon, from the Australian Securities Commission. You know, past performance is not a reliable indicator of future performance. I don't think anyone would deny that in terms of that domain. And in terms of climate, we actually have to start thinking in the same vein. Past climate is no longer a reliable indication of future climate. Our past experience of risk management in this Australian climate has to start to take into account climate change, and over time, our past will become less and less relevant to the changes and the decisions we have to make in terms of climate risk management. Now, in terms of food availability and similar things in terms of food systems, so climate change in the broad is actually going to bring significant challenges in terms of supplying adequate quantity of food of different types. We're actually really lucky and have been for quite a long time in Australia to have adequate food for our population. It is not necessarily going to be the case in the future unless we take action. And for example, our climate change interacting with population growth. Most people probably don't know this, but our top population scenario for 2100 in Australia is 64 million people. It's tripling the size of places like Adelaide. That's not an Australia I want to live in, but that's what those scenarios have. You have three times the number of mouths to feed, and you have climate change reducing your agricultural production, and all of a sudden, Australia, which is a gross exporter of various agricultural products, could become a net importer of agricultural products. The worst case scenario in this study was actually an importer to the same extent that we're currently an exporter. And that study actually indicated there was about a 1 in 4 chance that we'd become a net importer of wheat, of grain, which we're currently a gross exporter. And that grain is roughly about 12% of the traded grain internationally. And that's what actually keeps people in famines in Africa alive. That's the excess which we have that can actually go and feed about 60 million people around the world. We actually got lucky to have Penny Sackett in the audience, and she hosted a report on food security in a changing world. And this was one of the key things that we actually focused on, the importance of Australia in terms of its global positioning of this. Now, it's not just a future thing. I mean, we're actually seeing this already. This actually was a graph coming from that report, from the PMSEC report. And what that shows is already in the past, we used to be an exporter, in this case of vegetables. That's this line here. And we exported more than we imported. Now, over the last decade, that's actually flipped. We're actually now importing more than we export. And the difference between the two is actually growing over time. So we've actually already started to see, largely for climate reasons, this was the big impact of the decade-long drought, we're already seeing a situation where we're not providing adequate veggies for our current population. And this is a time when we're just realising we have to increase the intake of our vegetables for an adequate diet. It's not a really good picture. Now, there's also implications, as I said, for global food security, because, you know, we do feed people across the globe. We're likely to see an increased variability, and that's really important. Like, right now, we actually have the FAO food price index at an all-time high, record levels. So we already have food stress for poor people across the globe, and that's in part due to climate disturbances, climate change. We're also likely to see increased variability of supply. A really obvious one is bananas. 75% of our banana production in Australia removed by Cyclone Yasi, but also floods and droughts significantly impact on that reliability of supply. Likely to see changes in source regions. So in South Australia, work by Udai and Peter Heyman shows how climate change could actually move essentially the risk associated with goiters line significantly south. So we could actually lose significant slabs of cropping country in that sort of area south of the goiters line. And so that's not it's not an insignificant change that will happen in that region. Now, technology change, as assessed by those farmers, could help reduce that push south, but it's not likely to fully offset it. And lastly, we're likely to see changes in foods. So we're going to probably see more foods suited to climates of the future, like hotter, drier, more stressful climates. And so these are probably going to become part of our diet over the next several years. Now, it's not just food quantity, but it's also food quality. So one of the consequences of increased carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere is lower protein content in grains. But if you're a meat eater in Australia, that's probably not a big issue. But if you're a poor person in Africa who eats Australian wheat when they're desperate for food, that is probably an issue because they're actually already protein limited. It also could be an issue if you're actually a strict vegetarian in Australia and you don't look after the protein content of your diet. In terms of food hygiene, we know through very strong empirical evidence, including that collected here in Adelaide, that key organisms like Salmonella and Campylobacter actually increase the risk of food hygiene under hot conditions. Some things like rotaviruses actually decrease their incidence under hot conditions. Gastroenteritis, which is the consequence of those infections of your food, they're likely to increase at the rate of about 2.5% per degree Celsius. We currently experience something like about 54,000 cases of gastroenteritis a day in Australia. The climate change load on this is probably about 1,500 additional cases of that per day across the Australian population. Climate is related to wastage and loss, both before productive activities on farms and after productive activities on farms, such as grain storage, and climate change is going to make that more significant, probably increasing our loss factors. Climate already impacts on appearance of various products, such as sunburn on fruit, and that again is likely to increase. And wine flavour and also alcohol content also are affected very strongly by climate. So we're already seeing in terms of wine and grapes, there's actually a premium for grapes grown in cooler environments or cooler years, and quite a significant price differential there. And we're already seeing alcohol contents creep up as a result of the changes in sugar content flowing from climate changes, and those things are likely to increase. We've seen some significant adaptations from that industry already to deal with these things. Now, of course, adaptation is the action we can take in response to those threats. Essentially, adaptation, to put it really simply, adaptation is changing what we do to get what we want. It's not foreign. We all do that all the time. Businesses do it all the time. Governments do it all the time. We have obviously started to frame out what some of the issues associated with climate change, the costs of climate change would be. We're also starting to frame out the solutions, potential solutions to climate change. So Chris Stokes and I produced this book last year, which brought together scientists and others from industry right across Australia for every sector, significant sector of Australian agriculture, to scope out what the adaptation options are for agriculture. And those operate at different levels, farm level, community, regional level, and government level. And so what we're trying to do in CSIRO with colleagues such as Sadi from South Australia is we're starting to build the information and the capacity for people to make better adaptation decisions and effective adaptation decisions. And we're starting to identify and develop the options, the tools that people actually need to implement those things to adjust for climate change. Now, the standard sort of approach with science is give us more money, we'll produce more information. And in fact, it's a flawed view. Information doesn't have equal value. And these are some of the reasons why information does not, just automatically more information does not equal better decisions. It may not be relevant, it may not be appropriate or reliable or trusted, it may not be sourced legitimately, so through appropriate social processes, it may conflict with user values or interests, it may be unavailable or untimely, so it's too late for a decision, or it may be poorly communicated, and Amanda's going to talk later a little bit about the communication side of this. And fundamentally, it comes down the bottom to whose decision is better, and how do you actually start to frame a better decision in an uncertain environment, where there's lots and lots of different disparate goals that can be implemented. Certainly it's not my job as a scientist to actually say whose decision is better or to provide criteria for better decisions. It's actually up to the individual decision makers to start to pull together those bits of information that they can then piece together into a solution for their particular circumstances. It's my responsibility as a scientist to listen to them, to understand what their needs are, to perhaps prompt them a little bit about stretching the envelope, about options, and to also put in place some of the really strategic science that can deliver things 5 years, 10 years, 20 years down the track, which otherwise wouldn't get implemented. And because of this, that's why in my group we actually adopt a co-research approach. It's not just about the scientists, it's actually about the scientists and our various users, from farmers through to government policymakers. And a key part of this is to ensure we don't go down this pathway of maladaptation where we actually do some pretty dumb things. We haven't got the luxury of lots of trial and error. There's just too many costs associated with that. And the last couple of slides, Bob, just to let you know it's coming to an end. A few ideas, given that this is a festival of ideas, a few ideas about adapting to deal with uncertainty. So one of the things that might be a little bit contentious is if you actually start thinking about this as an ideology. So a simple definition of an ideology is a system of ideas and ideals. So it's not only about your ideas, but actually how they fit into what you want, that form the basis of policy and action. Now, I'm just proposing here, perhaps we actually need to start developing an ideology of adaptation in this harsh brown land of ours rather than one of denial. One that's positive, that takes us forward, that ultimately can change people's values. Technology, here we come. That can actually change people's values as we implement these things from a bottom-up process. And I think that's actually something that really could be constructive in this environment, where their ability to take this discussion and debate forward is actually hampered by these conflicts between what people perceive as problems associated with carbon emission reduction and put it in the basis of starting to see the positives from climate change adaptation. The key thing here is actually, this is actually not about, this is a fundamentally about practical activity. It's a pragmatic view of things. It's actually saying that recognizing, adapting to the change we see and foresee, even given uncertainties associated with the science, is far, far better than the alternative. The alternative is not adapting to the climate changes that we're seeing. Saying that these changes that I just showed you in South Australia somehow magically are going to turn around from going up and up and up, and they're going to loop over. There's no process that we understand that's going to tell us that that's going to happen. So what's the alternative? Is to either adapt to those changes and, if possible, take advantage of them, at least we can reduce the risks associated with them. The alternative is actually keep our practices lagging further and further behind the environment that we live in. And that will make us increasingly unable to maintain our natural resources, to maintain good livings for farmers, to actually maintain our export industries. I just don't see this as a viable option. We have to adapt, and we have to do it smart. Now, ideas have to be matched with actions, and these are just some of the things that I, in my role in CSIRO, and with colleagues throughout Australia and the world, are trying to do. Fundamentally, I'm trying to actually support people right across the food system, you know, farmers through the government people, to actually co-develop a set of better and innovative adaptation options, those tools and those processes and the information that they can use in their own context, their own decision-making framework. I will never be able to predict the way people are going to use these things that we can provide them, but we can actually make a fair judgment call and let them combine those little pieces together in their own way. We're also interested in assessing adaptive capacity and then building it. So actually starting to identify where that's strong and where it's not, and actually working out in a very, very fine-tuned way how to improve that adaptive capacity. And we've already done this, and we're world leaders at that. Critical parts of that adaptive capacity are the human and social components. It's what we know and how we link that to other people. We've heard some great presentations on networks here in this festival. And that social capacity is actually fundamental. And so I actually think we need to put a lot of effort into thinking about the networks and communication paths that we're going to actually implement and increasingly implement over the next decades. And so the Do Tank talk by Tim Jarvis and co, his stand-in the other day, was an example of that. Starting to actually pool, have ways of rigorously pooling those ideas and giving people access to those. Critically, it's about informing policy development, effective policy development as well. So the lower level adaptation activities can actually happen in a supportive environment where we actually have government understanding the challenge of adaptation and developing an adaptation policy, because at the moment we don't have a strong one here in Australia. And lastly, we need to actually be adaptive ourselves. We need to monitor what works, what doesn't, and why, so we can actually increasingly deal with the surprises that the future is going to bring us. And it's not just about climate change, it's about climate change plus all of those other things which are happening in the world. And that's a really significant challenge, and it's one we only can deal with together. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Mark. Outstanding talk. I'm sure we're all delighted with it. We're going to move straight on now to the next speaker, and then we'll have the question period following that. So hold those wonderful questions in your mind. I'd now like to introduce Amanda McKenzie, who's co-founder of the Australian Youth Climate Coalition and the Australian Climate Change Education Network, and named Banksia Joint Young Environmentalist of the Year. She is a passionate sustainability leader and social entrepreneur. She's led three Australian group youth delegations to the United Nations Climate Change Conference and has participated as a youth advisor to the Australian government's delegation in 2007. Welcome, Amanda.
Thanks, Bob, for that introduction. What I wanted to talk to you about today was, in this festival of ideas, it doesn't really matter how good your idea is if you can't get it communicated to other people. So what I wanted to talk about is how some of the ideas that Mark's put to us, why it is that in the current debate some of those ideas aren't cutting across, and how we can think about how we can better communicate some of those ideas. So I wanted to just start with how the climate change debate in Australia could be characterised. The first point is to say it centres around trust and integrity. And this is often caught up in whether people trust and think that the government itself has integrity. And over the last few years, the climate debate has just become increasingly and increasingly politicised. And it appears that the major parties are highly divided on this issue. And as with any complex policy issue and complex scientific issue, where there isn't bipartisan agreement, it tends to mean that the public, there's discord in the public. And it's not necessarily that the public doesn't want action, it's that the public doesn't really know what to think and doesn't know what to make of all of these issues. But it's interesting that actually the major parties agree on a lot. Firstly, that despite rumblings in both parties, actually, both parties agree that climate change is happening and needs to be addressed. Both parties have agreed that a 5% reduction target is the ambition that they've agreed to, and both claim to support some sort of market mechanisms to achieve that 5% target. And inherently, a 5% target will have some sort of cost, which you'd imagine would be embodied within that so-called market mechanism. So it's interesting that there is quite a lot of agreement, but the way that it comes across in the media is that there seems to be almost no agreement. So it shouldn't be a conservative or a progressive issue. Climate change is something that will affect all of us. And it is interesting that I think the conservative agenda has been taken up by the radical right wing and been made something that is an issue for them because it doesn't necessarily accord with their worldview. But that does not to say that it's not something that is highly relevant to conservatives, and conservatives all around the world have been pursuing in very good ways. You just have to look at the British government to see that. But climate change is a core issue of trust, and that's how the government is being assessed by the media as to whether they are, Julia Gillard in particular, whether she is competent and whether she's going to get the climate change policy through. But the politicised nature of the debate tends to mean that people are reluctant to speak out, particularly the business community that may have been a little bit more vocal around the 2009 debate with the CPRS, has almost shut up entirely because they're too scared to look like they're on one side of politics or the other side and the implications for them. But I think it runs through the community. I think people, when you see in the media what appears to be a vitriolic debate, and particularly when you look at some of the anti-carbon tax rallies, which seem very nasty, I think a lot of the average Australians think, oh, well, I don't want to be part of that debate. I feel a bit, it's not really me and it's not really the space that I want to be in. But I'm now working at the Climate Commission, and I can tell you that we travel around Australia consistently, going to regional areas and cities and all over the place. And lo and behold, Australians are a really respectful bunch. They're a kind and generous and caring bunch. And overall, it's only the 0.001% that tend to be very aggressive in their opinions. Most people are very happy to listen to anyone's opinion and to hear it here, there. So I think that it's about trust and integrity, it's partisan and it's negative. It's also that Penny Sackett actually said this the other night, that policy and science have been conflated. So it's a shame that with the politicised nature of the debate, that it's politicised the science around climate change. And there's no better example of that than Andrew Bolt's program this morning on Channel 10, which he brought together three climate scientists, none of which were actively participating in the field, to talk about whether the climate science had been, in fact, decided. And they each made the case that, in fact, it hadn't. So it was interesting and worrying, I think, that one of the major media institutions can consistently be putting that sort of dialogue on national television. Of course, everyone's welcome to their opinion in a democracy, but there's obviously got to be some point in which the majority opinion facilitates action. You just have to think about vaccinations. Sure, there's a group of people, a minority, that say we shouldn't vaccinate our children and it's bad for them. But the majority of us think that it's a good idea, and we would think it was abhorrent to leave generations of children not vaccinated for the sake of finally getting a consensus on the argument. Similarly, with climate change, we just need to get on with it, despite that there's a minority opinion that doesn't exist. That disagrees. What's interesting, though, is that if this is the character of the debate, the story of inaction is actually the most powerful. This is a story of inaction. So, firstly, climate change isn't happening. If it is happening, it's not caused by humans. If it is happening and if it is caused by humans, we can't do anything about it in Australia because we're only a small percentage of global emissions and we can't make a difference. It's unfair for us to act. Who has heard this story before? And who thinks that without seeing this, you could probably recite it? You just have to contrast that to the story of action, which I'm sure everyone would probably have a different way of putting. There's not a concise way, but this has been distilled systematically by the proponents of inaction to make a concise and easy to understand story. Interestingly for us, none of it is factual. None of these propositions is based on fact. And I just wanted to touch on why that is, and Mark has gone into it already. But as we've seen in his presentation from some of those graphs, the Earth is warming. We can see this in the air surface temperature records, in the ocean. We can see it in the impacts that it has on glaciers and other ice bodies. And that's not predictions, that's not modelling, that's just observed evidence by scientists. We trust scientists to observe stuff all the time. We trust doctors to observe whether we have cancer or not. We accept so many observations in science, and in generally when we look at some of those weather graphs about what the weather's going to be tomorrow, we trust that on the basis of a range of observations. So similarly, on the basis of a range of observations, the world is definitely warming. Secondly, so that's the first proposition. The second proposition is that climate change is actually caused by humans, and I'm sure most of you in this room are probably of the view that that's true. I just wanted to show you one graph that I think is powerful in doing that. Oh, sorry, the next one. So this is the period of 1900 to 2000, so a 100-year period. And this is, you often hear that if the case for inaction, that it's actually volcanoes or it's solar radiation that's causing warming. Well, let's look at the modelling over that period of what the temperature would have been over that 100 years if it was just volcanoes and solar radiation. That's a rough line. Then if we add human greenhouse gas emissions and we model it over that period with the solar radiation and the volcanoes as well, this is the line that you'd expect. Now, the good thing we have is we have actually been through this 100-year period, so in addition to the modelling, we have the observed evidence. And this is the line of observed evidence. So consistently, you've seen this sort of thing, you've seen many things in the media as well as from the scientists. It's and for a layperson, that you often hear about the scientific uncertainty, but of course, scientific uncertainty exists in every sort of realm of science. But for a layperson, a 95% certainty of science is certainly enough from a risk management proposition to take action. And so I'd say that for a layperson, climate change is certainly caused by carbon dioxide. The next point was that the world isn't moving on this issue. And that therefore Australia shouldn't act, and Australia isn't important. But of course, Australia is one of the top 20 emitters of greenhouse gases. We've got 180 countries that are behind us that are smaller emitters, and just about a lot of them have a bigger population than we do, because of course we're one of the top emitters in terms of our per capita. And you just have to look at some of our trading partners or some of our neighbours to see some of the action on climate change. And a lot of these countries aren't necessarily motivated by the moral proposition of climate change. They're motivated by the opportunities that exist in clean energy. So that might be China, for instance, is introducing a pilot emissions trading scheme, which is maybe small for them, but when it covers six cities, it will cover 250 million people, which they're planning to do by 2015. And you look at the US, you hear that the US nationally isn't doing anything, and certainly they're not doing enough. But you look at California, the eighth biggest economy in the world. The only bright spot in that economy is clean energy, and they'll be introducing an emissions trading scheme in a few years. And of course, the EU has been acting on this for a number of years, and Britain is one of the leaders with a 50% reduction target by 2027. But it's interesting that despite all this factual information, that powerful story of inaction continues to be something that everyone understands. It's simple, it's concrete, and it says a basic emotional story that we don't have a problem, but even if we do, there's nothing we can do about it, so don't worry. And there are powerful advocates. I'd mentioned Andrew Bolt, but in general, the radical right of the media landscape consistently puts this story out in a very clear and concise way. And if you look at the crikey list of the top powers in media, the top 10, at least six of them are sceptical of the science and are consistently putting their views to the population. So if that's where it exists now, what's the story of action? And I've got three ideas for, I think, how we can improve and change the debate. The first is to focus, as Mark said, not just on facts, but on values. So we've often started conversations about climate change from the facts, from the graphs, from the propositions that we've heard from Mark. But we assume that if people just knew the facts, that they'd be convinced. but they haven't been. So it must be the case that the facts alone aren't enough. They're necessary but not sufficient. So we need values in order to help people contextualise these issues. I could talk about stewardship, I could talk about responsibility. As a member of a younger generation, I have a simple request to leaders in generations older than me, which is that they leave the planet essentially how you found it when it came to you. And I promise that with our generation, we'll try our best to do the same for our children and grandchildren. And that's a stewardship message that has resonance with generations of Australians, indeed people around the world that have tried to leave the world or just their patch a little bit better for their children and grandchildren. I could talk about values of opportunity and prosperity. Australia is one of the sunniest countries in the world. We could be a leader in renewable technology. The first solar billionaire is actually an Australian who developed technology at the University of New South Wales and then has capitalised and commercialised that technology in China. So we haven't got the fruits of that. If you look at Germany, one of the leaders in solar energy, the best place in Germany for solar energy capture is equivalent to the worst place in Australia, down in the Tarkine Valley in Tasmania on the west coast. So you've got to think, like, we've got all of this sun, we've got all of this space, we could do something really productive with it. So I could have talked about stewardship, leadership, responsibility, opportunity, collaboration and bringing the community together. There's a range of values that can be useful on this issue. But I think one way to think about values, though, is that we often talk about climate change at, if you've heard about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you can think about physiological needs, which are, you know, your average food and shelter, go up one step to safety needs, which are your economic prosperity and your financial security, go up one more level to social needs, which is your love and belonging in your family and with your friends. One step up is esteem needs, how you're respected in the community. And self-actualisation is on the top. So that's your capacity to care about bigger than self issues, like climate change. And we usually start right at the top talking about climate change, talking about the moral imperative to act. But often we forget to talk right down the bottom about food, about health, which are the issues that deeply resonate with every one of us because they're relevant to our daily experience. And the moral propositions doesn't necessarily resonate with everyone. Well, this can. And you look in contrast to the story of inaction, which is about cost of living, which is, again, right down the bottom of the pyramid. So I think food in and of itself is a useful tool for us to communicate why climate change matters to the average person. So that just takes me back to this list of the second one, which is consider what matters to the audience. Start from where the audience is. The public isn't stupid, and they're not to be disrespected. The next point is to paint a positive and compelling vision of the future. We've had a discussion about the carbon price this year with not a lot of discussion about what that price will actually achieve. What is the vision for Australia? Where do we go when we solve this problem? It's not necessarily about just solving the problem. We can look at how we create a better community and a better society in doing so. How can we make energy cheaper but also cleaner? How can we make our cities more accessible, cleaner, user-friendly? How do we make our buildings work so they're healthier? How do we make farmland more productive and crops more nutritious? Can we use the necessity of innovation to help us both deal with the climate crisis, but also use it as a platform to create lots of new technologies that is going to advantage us in lots of different ways? How can we use the climate crisis to make our global community more just and more connected? So it's not just about the problem, it's about the solution. And we often lament the lack of leadership that we see from our politicians. But leadership isn't connected to a particular position or a particular title. It's the capacity of all of us to take leadership in our own lives. And we can never have a debate that is not centred on some of those things that I outlined at the start unless each one of us is willing to participate in that debate, lifting the calibre of that debate, making it more respectful and making it more positive. It's the eternal, the price of liberty, as Andrew Jackson said, is eternal vigilance of the people. And I think we all have a responsibility in democracy to make that happen. We live at a time that matters. We have an incredible privilege to live at a time when the impact that we make on the world can actually have a difference for a really long period of time. So thank you for listening. I'll pass back over to Bob.
Thank you very much for an outstanding talk. Amanda, I just noticed that your last point in the story of inaction is encapsulated in a series of TV ads at the moment about a certain matter. How do we get past this distrust on all sides in this debate? Do you have any suggestions?
Well, as I was saying about leadership, I think it's required on all of our parts to lift the debate. So politicians aren't... I think in some ways politicians are dealt with in the media unfairly. I think a lot of politicians on all sides have good intentions. There are some with probably not optimal intentions, but it requires giving credit where credit's due to where things actually work well. I think the Labor government at the moment has put through some good things. As we often only hear of the bad things, and I think that leads to a position of a lack of trust. But I think it's also incumbent on all of us to... we often hear about the media and lament the role of the media in all of this, to hold the media to account. Their companies, they react to public reaction to what it is that they do. So if we send letters, if we call them when they're doing things that we think we don't agree with, or we think is fostering something that is to the detriment of Australian society, we can actually have an impact.
Thank you. Mark or Amanda... driving change is a difficult thing, and sometimes governments had to step in. Like, I now wear a seatbelt. I fought that for a long, long time, but I saw some accidents and changed my mind. I find reluctance about giving up drinking and driving, but reality, there is a law that stops me from doing that and smoking in public places. Is this where we're headed, where we're going to have to drive our politicians to enforce some change, Mark?
Want me to deal with that?
Yes.
Okay.
Both of you, go for it.
There's no single pathway here, is that we actually have to do this on multiple paths. It's really important, I think, to make sure that the framing of the policy from the government perspective is appropriate, and that means they need to recognise the benefits and costs of different pathways. And I think this is only just starting to be included in the policy process, where we're actually starting to look at the benefits from proactive adaptation versus reactive, which is where we've been in the past at best. And then starting to think about, well, it's not only about the national interest in the sense of, you know, other actors, but there's also a clear governmental interest in terms of their own assets, in terms of having those assets adapted as well. So I think from a policy perspective, there's a range of potential drivers, and critically, those, if we want to move down an adaptation pathway, we have to have a series of policies and procedures which actually are supportive of that adaptation. At the moment, we have a series of barriers.
Yeah. If any of you wants questions, could you please move to the back of the hall there, where there is a microphone? Please feel free to jump in. I can see people moving in that direction. One of the pieces of data that you presented, Mark, was imports of vegetables. Is this about climate change, or is this about good old-fashioned economics, where it's cheaper to fly in peas from China than for us to grow them?
Look, all of these big changes are driven by multiple things. So there's a climate change signal there. There's also industry restructuring signals tucked away in there. I'm not aware of anyone who's actually teased those things apart for Australian agriculture. There have been efforts, say, for the biofuels impacts overseas as related to food prices and sort of teasing that component apart. So, you know, what's due to biofuels competing with food, and, you know, what's due to reductions in infrastructure, what's due to climate, what's due to market forces. So these things always happen for multiple reasons, but clearly the big drought in the Murray-Darling, which is, you know, a food bowl for a lot of those industries that produce fruit and veggies, that was hitting hard.
Yep. There's a question at the back, is that right?
Yes. Okay. Yes, I like your approach, both of you, to changing the way we look at this and putting the problem at the centre, changing that to turning around and looking at our values and ideals. And it makes me think of something that happened yesterday in the talk on carbon tax and climate change. And someone suggested maybe we should go back to fear and greed to drive that along. And one of the guest speakers responded that Al Gore released his film, and he characterised that as a tool of fear, where I think it was actually information and concern. He said since that time, the public has become more cynical and disengaged from understanding and responding to positive messages about climate change. I think he's wrong. I think the reason that's happened is not because of Al Gore's film, because vested interests got in there and went hammer and tongs for even more fear from the other side. So it seems to me you're talking about not falling into that trap.
If you wanted to respond,
sure. Very much so, is that if you actually focus on adaptation, people will only do an adaptation to whatever situation if it actually benefits them in some way. So it actually, in some dimension of things that they value, it actually improves their lot. So inherently, adaptation is done because people actually see it as bringing benefit to themselves. So it actually takes it out of that fear domain quite significantly. So the challenge from a policy perspective is that what you have then is a series of adaptations which might be fostered, including through public expenditure, which actually bring private benefit. So part of the government policy development has to actually be able to make a case why that expenditure is in the national interest and why there's national benefit from that through accumulated individual private benefit. And again, that's something which has really only just started to come through.
Another question at the back.
Yeah, I'm a retired chemical engineer. I've been involved in the energy issue for many years. I'm also acting like a two-year-old, so I'm starting all over again as well. Look, there are many people around with good ideas on climate change, okay? One of the problems is who can we go to listen? That's one. And then you've got to influence two forces to do something. First of all, the government's got to act. It's proven over the years that the government has the main influence in energy policies. Now, generally, they're irresponsible. They don't care. They're more worried about their wages than anything else. But what we need to do is get some other influence to put pressure on them. And the media is the best. The media could have a major role in influencing the government to change policies, to do something about climate change. I was involved in the first climate change conference in Australia 25 years ago, okay? I've been concerned about it ever since, and I went to a conference a few minutes ago. It was discussed down the road. But we've got to do something. My question is there some organisation that people with good ideas can go to have these matters considered and then put into effect? I would say, if I had a guess, I'd say the CSIRO would be number one to go to. Okay?
Thank you for the question. Amanda, you've talked to us about change and you've had some successful public programs. He's talking about that same thing. What levers do we pull? What organisations do we go to? How do we stop feeling suicidal about this?
Well, I think that there's a range of organisations that have been working on this, whether it's Australian Conservation Foundation, Ian sitting down the front, or whether it's GetUp or the organisation that I founded, the Australian Youth Climate Coalition, that have been working on this issue. And the foundation for a lot of those organisations is that government won't act unless the public demands it of them. If you look at any large-scale social change of this type of nature, you haven't seen it being led by government or business. You've seen it being pushed by the public. And if you think about whether it was slavery, remember in Britain, the arguments against why you would stop having slaves was that, the economy is going to fall apart if we don't have slaves. The argument about, like, can we have an eight-hour day? The economy is going to fall apart if we have an eight-hour day. We need people to be working these ridiculously long weeks. There's been a substantial amount of those sorts of movements that have moved society forward. So I think it does require the community to come together to put pressure on government. And there are groups doing that in the community now that you'd be very welcome to join and get involved with and are consistently doing advocacy work on this. And it does require the community to come together. In terms of what you said about the media and the media's role, I think that similarly to what I was saying earlier, there's been a lot of pressure on the media from vested interests and from proponents of inaction to change the dialogue in the media, and they've been consistently successful. If you look at the way that the media has changed in how they've looked at this issue, it's partly just because of the groups complaining about it. That every time that there's a climate scientist on the ABC, someone rings up the ABC and says, where's the climate skeptic? You have to have balance. Obviously, that doesn't reflect the true balance in the science, but someone's complaining about it, so then they have to react. But consistently, when the Sky News, I saw this last week, had a panel of very conservative right-wing pundits who were all talking about their scepticism of the science, and I would be surprised if anyone rang up and complained. So I think if we think that we want to lift the public discourse, it has to be through doing things like that, through calling people out when they're doing things that don't reflect having a true balanced debate.
Mark, this may seem...
I should just respond to that too, is that within the agriculture sector and food industry sector, there actually are mechanisms, including Landcare, for doing that. And a lot of the state agencies, such as those in South Australia, are a centre for going for that sort of information. Within the agriculture, a lot of the innovation actually occurs from the farmers, and so it's not imposed on them, it actually is bottom-up. And there are programs such as the Climate Champions program run by GRDC at the moment, which brings out those good news stories about how people have dealt with this in a really constructive way and communicates that to other people. So there are mechanisms sitting in there to deal with this. One of the important things, though, is mitigation is actually quite different from adaptation in terms of the degree of centralisation of it. So for example, a carbon policy, carbon tax policy, would be pretty much the same if implemented in Australia as it would be in New Zealand, for example. Putting a set of solar panels on your roof is pretty much the same as it is in Germany as it is in Australia. There's actually a huge amount of commonality across that, and that commonality allows a lot of centralised processes. In contrast, adaptation is almost different every time you apply it. So if you've got one farm next to another, they'll actually be very different in terms of aspirations, in terms of management systems, etc. And even though they may be similar in other ways, you'll need to have different adaptation options for those different systems. So adaptation generally is actually much more fragmented, and it requires a lot more complexity in terms of how you analyse it from a policy perspective to come up with sensible options.
Thank you, Mark. I've just been given the signal from the back there, and we're going to have to wind this up. Today we've heard some wonderful messages. We've heard some messages of facts. We know where we stand, and there's nothing more clear to us to find paths forward than to have the facts rather than dealing with hearsay. We've also heard some messages of hope, and I'm, for one, is not as despairing as I was, and all I wish was I was 50 years younger to start all over again. So will you please join me in thanking the speakers.
This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2011 was recorded by Radio Adelaide, through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library, and Flinders University Library.